pleasure to welcome one of my favourite writers, I should say, who was also revels in the glorious title, the J.R.R. Tolkien Professor of English Literature and Language at the University of Oxford. Tolkien, you know, that man who wrote the greatest essay about Beowulf in modern critical history. We are here to celebrate this extraordinary book and a very remarkable character. I have to keep Marianne reminding myself that she's not real. And this is part of the fact that there is a framing device and she is also the teller of a tale. But Chaucer's Wife of Bath, you say, and I completely believe everything you say, must have been his favourite, because he gives her more life, more love, more energy.
Exactly. So I think she was certainly his favourite character, and she's been almost every reader of the Canterbury Tales' favourite character as well. Not everyone. You get a few people like Blake who say she's a scourge and a blight, you know, an image of what's wrong with women. But Chaucer, I mean, we can see that she's his favourite by what he does. So that in the Canterbury Tales, there's usually a prologue and then a tale, and most of the prologues are quite short, and then three characters get longer prologues, which are called the confessional prologues, or we hear more about them. They're all quite marginal figures who get this greater opportunity to talk about themselves, which I think is really interesting. But the other two who get the longer confessional prologues, they're about 200 or 300 lines. The Wife of Bath's 850. You know, Chaucer really wants us to understand her better and give her more chance to speak. And then he also puts her into some of the other Canterbury Tales and into one of his short poems. So he doesn't do that with any other Canterbury pilgrim, but he makes her into a figure that jumps out of her text, gets into one of his other poems called The Envoy to Buckton. And that's the beginning of what I call her career as a kind of book jumper, where she gets out of her own book, jumps into other books, and then keeps doing that right up to the present day, where so many authors take her on and let her have a new life outside her original text.
Your contention is that she is the first ordinary woman in English literature, except that she's extraordinary. But can you just explain what you mean by ordinary woman?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'll just flick onto a little image of her, shall I, while we're talking. So that's one of the earliest images of her from a famous Chaucer manuscript from around 1400, so from around the time of Chaucer's death. So when I talk about her as an ordinary woman, I think partly it's important to see that in the context of what women were like in literature before the Wife of Bath. So, of course, there were lots and lots of women in English literature. But people were used to reading about women who were, on the one hand, good women. So queens, damsels in distress, marriageable princesses, saints, nuns. And on the other hand, bad women. So witches, prostitutes, procuresses, old crones, those kinds of women. The Wife of Bath, Alison of Bath, she is a middle class. We would think for the middle class woman. She is middle aged. She has a job. She talks a lot about her sexual desires. She's sexually active. She goes on holiday. She has friends. She does lots of things which readers then and now will find they can connect with. You know, we can use that word relatable. But people do see her as, you know, but she does have lots of recognisable aspects about her. But that is, of course, what does make her extraordinary, because there haven't been women like this before. Women like that don't exist in literature before. And not only does she exist, but she gets this very dramatic voice.
Can I just scroll you back just for a second to she goes on holiday.
Yeah.
She goes on pilgrimage.
Yeah.
Like not once, not twice, but three times to the Holy Land.
Yeah.
How extraordinary is that for, forgive me, real people, as opposed to the people in literature?
So everything about the Wife of Bath is excessive. So she gets married five times. She goes to Jerusalem three times. She has a particularly enormous hat. You know, I mean, everything is a bit cartoony, a bit larger than life. But it's not absurd. So when you read about medieval women, for example, there are lots and lots of examples of women who were married, you know, four times, for instance. You know, the Wife of Bath, her fifth husband, she marries when she is a bit over 40 and he's 20. Now, when I was looking at historical kind of historical analogues, I suppose, I found an example of a 15th century duchess. Her fourth husband she married when she was 65 and he was a teenager. So these are not extreme, you know, ludicrous. I mean, that is extreme. But the wife of Bath is not an extreme, ludicrous example.
Can I just ask you about the particular conditions of widowhood and remarriage? Yes. There's something about yes. English law, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. And then I will also get onto your point that you asked me about pilgrimage yeah. and travel as well. Okay. But that is really important. So widows in England were in quite a good situation. And I think when I talk about these kinds of things, I think I do have to caveat it by saying, of course, there were a lot of problems. I mean, I don't want to pretend this was some ideal time. It was so great to be a medieval woman. I mean, obviously, it wasn't. You know, you didn't have the vote. You didn't have decent medical care. Many women were dying in childbirth. Of course, there were lots of problems. But when we compare what it was like to be a woman in 14th century England or other parts of Northwest Europe, it was a lot better than it was in most other parts of the world at that time. And in many ways, it was better then than it was a couple of hundred years later.
And significantly better than it would have been in, say, Italy yes. or one of the southern yes, European, Catholic, exactly. more Catholic countries.
Exactly. So, though it isn't about Catholicism, because, of course, everyone is Catholic in this part of Europe as well. But yes, compared to southern okay. Europe. But so some of the conditions were kind of enhanced by the plague. So the plague was, of course, demographic catastrophe. But for those people who survived, conditions were a lot better because you've suddenly got, you know, the same amount of land to farm, half the people to farm it. So wages went up dramatically. The government tried to suppress them, but they couldn't. Many more people moved to towns, got better jobs, and that worked for women as well as men. So more women entered the workforce. But there were already quite good inheritance conditions for women. So if you were a widow, you would keep at least a third of your husband's property automatically. In London, you would keep more. You had more rights to the goods as well. You also had rights to your children's inheritance until they got older. You could control that, which gave you more income. And you didn't lose this money if you married again. So in contrast...
So that's the key part, isn't it?
Yes, but for lots of women, they didn't get it, even if they didn't marry again in other parts of Europe. So say in Italy, they only got their dowry back. So any work that they did during their marriage, they couldn't profit from. There was no incentive to work. And they only got their dowry back if they stayed with their husband's family. If they went back to their natal family, that family would get the dowry back, but they would lose access to their children. So they were not incentivized to marry again. But even being a widow, you stayed under the control of your parents-in-law or brothers-in-law. So in England, widows had a lot more power and then had power to, you know, choose their own next husbands if they wanted to. And many women at this time, widows in particular, they did inherit a lot, but they also, lots of women had jobs and they could earn reasonable money. So again, lots of people imagine that medieval women had very limited domestic existences. But in fact, lots of them had had jobs in many different areas. I mean, and while they mainly worked in, say, domestic service or the victualling trade, so brewers, food sellers, cloth trade, weavers, but you occasionally find examples of women who were, say, a parchment maker or a ship owner or a blacksmith, you know, these fascinating individual medieval women who were living these, you know, unexpected, risky lives. And when we look across Europe, there were particularly conditions in Northwest Europe, so in the Low Countries and England, where something called the European marriage pattern prevailed, which tended to mean people were marrying a bit later, and there was a system called neo-locality, where you wouldn't stay living with your parents, but would set up a new household. Now,
Sorry,
in order to do that...
Hang on, what do you mean by yeah. a bit later? Are we talking 13-year-olds, like in Italy, or
No, so people were marrying in their 20s, mainly, right. unless they were high aristocrats. So it was actually worse to be a very rich woman. They were much more under the control. So if you were a princess or a duchess, daughter of Duke and Duchess, it was worse.
So go back to
the mercantile women.
Thing.
Yeah, so it would be more or lower class women. They would save up money. They and their both partners would be saving up money to marry in their 20s. That then means, of course, they have fewer children, which is also better for women's, you know, health and opportunities. And because they would form their own household and they had their own money, they were less under the control of their fathers. They had more opportunity to choose their own spouses. So all of these things, which, as I say, pertain particularly in Northwest Europe, really, you know, helped women to have, you know, more opportunities, more freedom. And I think it's really important that we see a figure like the Wife of Bath in that context, because, I mean, obviously, one thing that I do in this book is I talk about the Wife of Bath right across time. She has really spoken to people for, you know, 650 years in lots of different cultures. But I don't think she is a timeless character, because particularly in the medieval era, but today as well, there are cultures in which the idea of a woman who can have a job, can talk about her sexual desire, can get married several times, can go on holiday without her husband, that kind of woman is unimaginable in many cultures.
We've got the context of history for real women, and we now have the other context of the story and who gets to tell the story. Now, Chaucer is a man who creates this. What does he create, or does he? I mean, we're getting something from Boccaccio, I presume. We're getting some ideas from Europe and other literary sources, but this is his creation, and the particular sort of proto-feminist spin that he gives is remarkable. But the question really is who tells the tale, or as you put it, or she puts it, who paints the lion?
Yes, let's. So this is an example of what people think lions look like when they've never actually seen lions, you know. But the point of that quote, who painted the lion, so in the Wife of Bath's prologue, she says at one point that everything has been written by men. So she's referring to a fable that would be very familiar to Chaucer's readers. And in this fable, a human and a lion are looking at an image in which a man triumphs over a lion. And the lion says, yeah, but who painted that? And the point is, you know, history is written by the victors. A human is saying, aren't humans great? If a lion had done the painting, it would be a painting of a lion ripping a man apart. And that fable hadn't been applied to the relations between the sexes before. And in the Wife of Bath's prologue, she is saying, well, the stories have all been written by men, and that's why they all say that women are terrible. You know, she says in that same bit of the prologue, if women had written stories as men have in their oratories, they would have said of men more wickedness than all the Mark of Adam may redress. So she is kind of foregrounding that issue of women not having had the chance to speak, of the canon being biased against them. You were asking about where Chaucer gets the Wife of Bath from, and that's really important because, of course, Chaucer is never writing in a vacuum. And his main sources for the Wife of Bath are, so going back to classical times, Ovid's Dipsas, and then, most importantly, the Romance of the Rose, so Le Roman de la Rose, the French, very influential French text written in the 12th and 13th centuries, in which there's a figure called La Vielle. Now, the Wife of Bath comes quite closely in many ways from La Vielle, but there are really crucial differences. And one of the most important differences is that La Vielle is indeed the old prostitute. She's not a respectable married woman. You know, the Wife of Bath, she might push respectability to its limits, but she is respectable. You know, she's not an old prostitute. She's not, you know, she's been married several times in a way that's entirely normal within that social context. When we get to the tale, so there's this long prologue in which the Wife of Bath talks about her own life, and particularly, you know, she talks about domestic abuse, and that domestic abuse is partly caused by the male canon. Her husband keeps reading this book of wicked wives, which talks about how terrible women are, and it's a collection of books by men such as Saint Jerome, Theophrastus, who've said all these terrible things about women, and these collections of books of wicked wives are based on real medieval manuscripts where someone would collect lots and lots of misogynist texts. So I do think that this is not a flippant reference to say it's like a modern internet algorithm. You know, you read something and you will then be fed things that back up your preconceptions. If you have a certain attitude, you will keep having that backed up. You know, it's like a version of that where you keep seeing how awful women are. All these authors say it because that's what you're choosing to read a package of.
Can I? I know there's an image you want to show, a Dutch image that you want to show.
Oh, yeah.
Which I guess before we get to the story she tells, can you just tease out a bit? Because we will be returning with Christine de Pizan on Friday to the Roman de la Rose. But the broader culture of misogyny shows itself in all sorts of ways, even to the point of the suspicion of women going on pilgrimage.
Yes, absolutely. And that links back to the travel question as well. So, yeah, so this amazing image, which is what you think it is, yes, it is a... It's a vulva brooch. Actually, you might not have thought it was a brooch, an attractive piece of jewellery. So this is a medieval pilgrim badge. And so when people went on pilgrimage, they would often buy souvenirs, pilgrim badges. And a lot of those badges were obscene, you know, which may seem odd to us, but they were often obscene. But this one, I think, is not just obscene, it is misogynist. Because what that image shows is a vulva wearing, dressed as a pilgrim, so with a pilgrim hat, with a pilgrim staff, which does look a bit like a penis, and also carrying a rosary, wearing little shoes. And the idea of that badge is that a female pilgrim is just walking genitalia. She's only gone on pilgrimage for sexual adventures. She's sexually available. She has no devotional intent. She has no brain. She has no voice. She's just a sex object. And, you know, we have lots of records of women going on pilgrimage, and they went for many reasons. I mean, often devotional reasons, of course. Sometimes they would do business on pilgrimage. Sometimes they would be going for a holiday to have fun. Sometimes they would have sexual adventures, but they certainly weren't indiscriminately sexually available. And what we see in lots of pilgrimage accounts is medieval women's anxiety about rape on pilgrimage. You know, their knowledge of the necessity of travelling in a large group, of sleeping with other women in the room around them, of being careful all the time. You know, they were certainly not sexually available. I mean, an example, you were asking about how common it was for women to go on pilgrimage before, and certainly going to Jerusalem three times would be highly, highly unlikely. But well-off women did go on pilgrimage. I mean, poorer women would go on local pilgrimages, you know, within England, you know, close by. There were lots and lots of pilgrimage locations. We have many examples, and I have a chapter in the book about the wandering woman, about lots of women's interesting pilgrimages around Europe to the Holy Land. A great example is Marjorie Kemp, the 15th century of mystic, who was a married woman with lots of children, who then had turned to God. And she went on pilgrimage to the Holy Land and to many other places, many of the places that the Wife of Bath goes, so Rome, Santiago. And when she went on pilgrimage, again, she was traveling in a large group. And this group got really sick of her and refused to travel with her anymore. And they had two major complaints. Remember that she's on a pilgrimage. One of their complaints was that she talks about God all the time. And they really didn't like that. And the other complaint was that she was a vegetarian. And they didn't like that either. So they said she could only stay with them if she would stop talking about God or would eat the same food as them, which she refused to do. So they abandoned her. She had to find another group. But the woman I'm really interested in is that story, is her maid, who is really ruthless, abandons her as well, goes off with the others. And then Marjorie finds her in Rome. And this maid has now hugely elevated herself on the social ladder, has got a great new job in the English Hospice in Rome, which is a hotel in Rome that catered to English tourists. She has the keys to the cellar there. She distributes the wine. She gives her old employer some charity at that point. So she's ruthless, but she's seized opportunities. You know, she's done interesting things with her life, and medieval women could do that.
Okay, let's get back to Alison, because she, within her group of pilgrims, isn't shut up, or even when they try to shut her up, she just talks them through it.
Yep.
Can we get to her story?
Yes, absolutely.
Because it's in all sorts of ways incredibly radical, isn't it?
It is, and it relates precisely to what I was just talking about in terms of showing that women are not sexually available, because, you know, this idea that medieval misogyny, you know, emphasised all the time, and this story shows the exact opposite. So the story begins at the court of King Arthur. So you've got King Arthur, Queen Guinevere, you've got a knight on horseback riding around.
Chivalry.
Exactly. So you're reading that, and, you know, any reader is thinking, okay, so this knight is now probably going to do something like kill a monster, rescue a damsel in distress, you know, go through some trials, and, you know, but be a good guy. And instead, what happens almost immediately is that he rapes someone. And we're told that, you know, very starkly, you know, there is no ambiguity about it. And then the king wants to execute him. And the queen and her women say, no, let us decide his punishment. And they send him away to think about what women want. So it's an educative, reformist punishment where they They see this man who has not cared about what women desire at all. And they say, you have to go away. You have this year and day to find out what do women desire. And they sent him off on this quest. And so he has to ask all these women, and eventually he gets the answer from this monstrous, loathly lady figure who says, but you have to promise that you'll give me the next thing I ask for. So he says, fine. So he has the answer. Women desire maestry, which is, you know, there's lots of different ways of interpreting the kind of power that they want. Everyone agrees this is the right answer. But what she wants is for him to marry her. So he's horrified.
That's the payback for having told him.
That was the next thing she asked. He's horrified by this. But then she talks to him and she says, you know, but, and she turns out to be the center of ethics in the story. Again, you know, the young, handsome man is supposed to be the ethical center of a story, not the old, ugly, poor woman. But she's the person who says to him, you know, but why are you judging on appearance? What does Christ say? Where does value really lie? And then, you know, she says that he can choose whether she's going to be beautiful and unfaithful, or ugly but faithful. And in the end, he just says, "You decide. You do everything, and you're clever." Essentially, she says, "Okay, well, if you're letting me have the power, you can have it all." And then says, "I will be beautiful and faithful." And then, you know, for the reader of this story, then she becomes beautiful and obedient. And suddenly you're like, what? No, that's not what was supposed to happen. You know? And so then it ends in this way that most readers find very disturbing. You know, where it says, and then, you know, she obeyed him and everything. And, you know, they lived happily ever after, essentially. And then the wife of Bath goes on in the same sentence without breaking her stride to say, and I want God to send us husbands who will always obey us. And if he doesn't, I want those husbands to die of the plague. And so we get these kind of two radically different ideas of the relations between the sexes, both of which are kind of monstrous. But the tale also, you can see particularly how radical it is when you look at the other versions of it. So there are other versions of it circulating in English at around the same time.
And who are those versions written by?
So there's one version by Gower, Chaucer's friend and contemporary, and there's another anonymous version.
Right.
In both of those versions, the crime is not rape. So in one, it is it's a killing, but it's not a deliberate murder. It's an accidental killing. In another, it's a land dispute, and it's Arthur's land dispute that Gawain then kind of self-denyingly agrees to sort out. So it's not rape, and the knight is not culpable. He is still the hero in these other versions.
Does he still have to go through restorative justice? Does he still?
Yes. So he goes through all that, but it doesn't have coherence because he hasn't shown and. There's been nothing about female desire, and suddenly he has to go and find out what women want. It's not coherent.
Okay.
Chaucer's version makes it all be restorative justice rather than just be a bit random. And Chaucer's version also makes the knight into this villain, which he isn't in the other. In the other versions, he is being kind of put upon in some of the versions by kind of evil stepmothers who have enchanted the woman, and you know, so that the centre of gravity is very, very different. And Chaucer's version, so in some ways, as we've been saying, it is radical. It does foreground the idea that rape is a terrible crime. But it's not a story that you can rest very easy with, because one reading of the story is, but the rapist ends up with the young, beautiful wife. He ends up with a reward. You know, that is one way of reading it that, you know, many people find very disturbing. And I think that is an important part of the thinking about the Wife of Bath as a whole, that it's easy to get carried away with all the really interesting kind of proto-feminist aspects, but, you know, the Wife of Bath is much more complex than that. She's a really, you know, difficult, problematic character who's often, you know, aggressive and unpleasant and talks openly about all these terrible flaws, you know, embodies some aspects of misogyny herself, plays with that. She is not a kind of uncomplicated heroine figure. You know, she's difficult, no, and that's a positive thing,
I think. Intensely, if we are, and I realise I'm diving into absolute insanity here, but if we are going to drill for a second into the biographical detail of the author being the Wife of Bath, of the rape story,
yeah,
we are looking at her trauma with her last husband, which is the domestic abuse. I mean, and this goes back to your point about the
the corruptive bias confirmation misogyny from the books, what happens to her is that they get into a fight. He beats her so hard that she loses her hearing.
Yeah.
And yet she is still married to him at the time of going on pilgrimage, although going on pilgrimage without him, we should
She seems to have been widowed again, because she, although we don't hear about what's happened, but she says, welcome the sixth. She says, I'm looking for my sixth husband. But I think the key point in what you're asking is that but they are reconciled after the beating. And after that, she says that things go well between them after that, she tells us.
Okay. We have her there in Chaucer's version. This isn't published by Caxton for another few decades.
Yeah.
How does this story get spread? How does her story get... Is it told in the taverns? Is it passed manuscript by manuscript around? Because by the time that Caxton gets hold of it, it's a story that's known, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, so Chaucer's early readership... of course, readership is relatively small before print, of course. But Chaucer had various different kinds of circles. So he seems to have been being read... You know, on the fringes of the court, maybe at higher up in court, there's some suggestion of that. But certainly, you know, we know that people like kind of chamber knights, so people who were around the court but not the king were reading him, certainly. This is in his own lifetime, this is. But also, he was performing his poems and other people performing them in places such as the actual Tabard Inn, you know, which was a real place, and other inns. And we know that one of his texts was...
The Tabard Inn is basically the Lebri Poetry Festival of its day.
It's a nice image. But it was... So we know that one of his texts was sold to pay a debt in his own lifetime, for, you know, quite a cheap text there. We know that people who were a bit lower down the social scale, so, you know, merchants, scribes... And sometimes brothel owners, those kinds of people, were, you know, owned his texts and read from them. And then, as after his death in the 15th century, when particularly after the Lancastrians had taken over, English poetry was being kind of lauded in all kinds of ways, and poets in the 15th century take on Chaucer a lot, and that's when he starts to get this Father Chaucer kind of mantle.
Sorry, we should talk about this. This is English poetry.
Yes.
Can you just set us the context for what that means? As it not being Latin poetry, not being French poetry, this is our big moment of high-profile vernacular, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So that although, you know, English has an unbroken tradition of poetry, you know, going back to the kind of 7th century, there's always been English poetry, but it has this enormous upsurge in the second half of the 14th century. And not only poetry, but also that's when you get a lot more English in law courts, in legal writing, in medical writing, in scientific writing... Just a big development of English, which then builds up, of course, to the printing press in the 1470s. So in the late 14th century, so Chaucer's at the vanguard of that, but it's not only him, right? It's never actually just one person. You also have you have Langland, you have Gower, you have the Gawain poet, people writing in different dialects in different areas. But someone such as Gower, he writes three great poems, you know, one in Latin, one in French, one in English. I was just talking about who was reading Chaucer, so when you look at the wills of the nobility of the royal family, they're leaving books in French, you know, and Latin. They're not yet reading English books as prestige books. So English is still it's a language of much less prestige than Latin and French in England. And for a poet to write only in English is a very specific decision. You know, Chaucer certainly could have written in Latin or French, and he knew those languages very well. It's possible he did write some early poems in French, but they haven't survived. But that would be quite normal. He was moving in circles where most people were writing in French, particularly in his early kind of teenage 20s decades, when he was very much around great households, around the court. But he chose to write in English. And I think partly that was an international decision rather than a nationalistic decision, because he was, one of the things he's doing is he's imitating the Italians. So he had travelled repeatedly, you know, in 73 and 78, he goes to Italy on diplomatic missions, and he, unlike his contemporaries, could read Italian, probably because as a merchant's son living in multicultural London, he'd met lots of Italian bankers, merchants who were arriving at that time. You know, Chaucer was brought up in the ward of London that had more immigrants in it than any other ward of London. It was a place of trade and cultural exchange. So then he was the person that got picked to go to Italy, reads Dante, reads Boccaccio, reads Petrarch, thinks, well, I can do some of those things in English, and then develops new verse forms, new poetic lines that were very much developing things that people such as Dante and Boccaccio had done, but making them new in English.
Boccaccio's Decameron has 10
yeah.
really quite posh
yeah,
women. I mean, they're not anything like the pluralism and diversity and social spectrum that he has. I'm mildly intrigued by the idea of how the court or the power brokers who might have had access to the manuscripts would come to something that was so socially stretched. I mean, how did they read that?
Well, and I think one context is that earlier on in his career, Chaucer had written poems that the court would be expecting more. So his earliest poem that survives for us anyway is The Book of the Duchess, which is written in the style of the French Dites Amoureuses. So a love complaint, and it's about the death of John of Gaunt's first wife, who was the mother of Henry IV, Blanche of Lancaster. So it's a love debate. But the court had never read one in English before, had never heard one in accentual syllabic English verse. They'd only heard them in French verse, which sounds different, which they would think of as different. So that was the kind of poem which, in subject matter, was more expected for them, but would still have been surprising. When he gets onto the Canterbury Tales, so... I mean, I think that Chaucer, one of the things that he came to in his life, I think, was very much a recognition that he wasn't going to write for patrons. He wasn't going to write for people. And we see him in many of his poems kind of obliquely talking about that, showing what happens when someone tries to write according to what someone else wants. You know, he shows what's it like if someone is in a position, so this is the Manciple's Tale, where if you tell truth to power, you get silence. That's what happens in the Manciple's Tale. In The Prologue to Legend of Good Women, he showcases the idea of an author who is given subject matter by a patron, and the subject matter just becomes deadened for him. So I think he didn't care, essentially. I think he was kind of true to what he wanted to write. And I think when he was writing the Canterbury Tales, this is the part of his life when, although he's still attached to the court, he is, for most of that time, you know, he's in London, he's in Kent, he's not kind of living at a great household for most of that time. But I think it is absolutely crucial to recognise what is so different about this, which is this principle of variety, because it relates very much to the wife of Bath, I think, because wanting to give a voice to the wife of Bath is part of Chaucer wanting to give a voice to lots of people. So it's not only about women, it's about the socially marginal in other ways as well. His big thing is, let's listen to different voices, different genres, different forms, different points of view. We don't just want to hear one hegemonic voice.
Can I just ask you about her name? There's the prioress, there's, I gather, the second nun. Everybody else is described by their job title, basically. I would not doubt other people get stuck. The word Bath just gives me Regency Austin. What does Bath mean to a 14th century audience and writer?
So Bath was an important town, a town in wool country.
So rich
and important for wool and cloth production, which was England's only industry and wealth at that time. She does work in the cloth trade, but it's also part of, I think, although it's not in their names, we are told that other pilgrims come from different parts of the UK, and so Chaucer is also, well, of England, and but Chaucer is trying to kind of paint a picture of different regions to a certain extent, but it is only England. But I think it's also important to think about what the word wife means there, because wife could mean just woman at that time, but I think in her case it does also mean wife as part of her job, because she does, that is one of the important ways in which she has made money, she has been able to become economically independent, is through wifehood, widowhood, inheritance in that way.
Okay, can we move her on now, out of the 14th and even 15th century? the conditions that make this independent, sexually voracious, feel-good, gabby, great merchant and pilgrim so exciting in that time become quite problematic as the story goes on and the times change.
Yeah, and so the second half of this book traces what happens to her across time. And, you know, when I was researching it, I just could not believe how much I found. Because I knew a certain amount. But then, once I was doing the research, I was kind of thinking, can I find any author that hasn't written a version of The Wife of Bath? Because, you know, you look through it and you're kind of like, Shakespeare, James Joyce, Voltaire, Pope, Gay, Dryden, Sadie Smith. I mean, everyone seemed to have written a version of The Wife of Bath. And, yeah, there are lots of things to say about that. So I think what I saw a lot across time was this tension between, on the one hand, her voice, you know, keeps surfacing. There are so many versions. And many authors write more than one version. They'll write a version, then they'll return to it 10 or 20 years later. So John Gay, for instance, writes a play, 20 years, writes another play about her, you know, revises it. So the voice keeps coming forward. On the other hand, there's a lot of anxiety about that voice. Now, sometimes that anxiety comes from the writers themselves who are trying to punish her, to make her marry someone inappropriate, to do something bad to her. And sometimes it comes from the forces around the text. So one example, let's see, we'll come back to that maybe, but this one, the ballad. So there was a ballad, The Wanton Wife of Bath, written in the 16th century, and then we have records of it from 1600. Many, many copies of it. In both 1600 and 1632, the printers were threatened with prison and then put in prison, and the ballad was burnt. So this ballad caused all kinds of anxiety. I mean, it's a great story because it's like a sequel. The Wife of Bath dies, gets to Heaven's Gate, and they don't want to let her in. So she argues with all the patriarchs. So different biblical figures keep coming and saying, but you did this. And she says, oh, but you did X and Y. And then they kind of retreat. Eventually she argues with Christ, but says to Christ, you know, you forgave the prodigal son, and argues with him using the Bible. And she ends up, of course, getting in. And at different points, people seem to have found different things anxiety-inducing about this text. So that, for instance, later on we get Scottish versions. And the Scottish versions, they say explicitly, you know, we've stopped it being so Catholic. That's the problem, that she just kind of is able to repent and get forgiveness. This is all a bit too like confession. And the new version, the Scottish version, keeps talking about grace and faith alone and those kinds of, you know, those kinds of buzzwords. So emphasis, so she becomes a Protestant and then that's okay. But so that's, I think, a really, but and there's so many examples of this ballad. So that's one of the examples of, she keeps persisting, people keep trying to beat her back, but they can't actually keep her down.
So what happens when she gets into the 20th century? Actually, before we get to the 20th century, can we just take a moment to talk about Voltaire, who I always thought was a good guy?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Well, and there are many examples, I think, of kind of famously, you know, liberal philosophers who have a bit of a blind spot when it comes to women, you know? So Voltaire translated The Wife of Bath's tale from Dryden's version. So Dryden translated The Wife of Bath. He said he wanted to do her prologue, but he didn't dare. And he keeps saying in his prologue to the fables, he keeps returning to it and saying, it's just too licentious, but I really wanted to, but I can't. So he only translates the tale. And then Voltaire translates that. So that's the first time that she gets into France, you know, which is the beginning of her kind of journeys around the world, which is another, I think, interesting part of her story. And Voltaire, so, I mean, it is really disturbing when you read his version, because he really emphasizes the idea that this isn't really a rape, this isn't something we should take seriously. You know, he emphasizes the woman's appearance, describes her as you know, tempting Robert, who's the knight figure. You know, describes her very calm. So he describes it as being like a rape, but then can say she's very calm after. She asks for money. What she's annoyed about is not the rape, but about not being paid for it. And, you know, it's very, very disturbing. And then the language really focuses. So when you get to the whole, he's supposed to have sex with the loathly lady, that becomes the focus of the story, and that becomes the rape scene, that he's going to be raped by the woman by having to have sex with her. Although, of course, he had agreed to that. And then there's this kind of parodic, mock chivalric scene in which the woman is kind of saying, I know you can do it. And he's just like, well, I really can't. Like, I physically can't do this. And she's saying, no, no, you know. And then and Voltaire writes about how this will be a moment of great glory and women will always praise him for this amazing, amazing feat of arms that he is going to be able to have sex with this older woman. And then in the end, he manages it and everyone says how incredible this is. And so, I mean, so the whole thing becomes really focused on his erection and really focused on the idea that he is the one to feel sorry for. And that's what Voltaire does with this story about rape, educative punishment, and female ethics.
Okay.
Yeah.
Crash! Oh. Let's get to the 20th century, where things don't always get a hell of a lot better than Voltaire.
Yeah.
The life goes on. Her talking back, her ability to argue, is one of the most spectacularly attractive things about her, and to make her case and to persuade people. But there is, I mean, particularly recently, in the last sort of 30, 40 years, this wonderful way in which she's jumping into other cultures and other languages.
Yeah.
And I do want to talk about Chaucer and iambic pentameter and what he does with English. But before we get there, could we also talk about three recent versions of this story where she has been translated into Black British cultures?
Yeah, absolutely.
And why it is that she fits so well into those both patois and civilization?
Yeah. So I think just as a kind of preface to that, as you were saying, in the 20th century in general, she didn't fare well, and then the 21st century has been a bit better. So, but in the 20th century, one of the things that I just think it's really important to mention is that I found the most misogynistic responses to The Wife of Bath came in the 20th century. And I think that is really, you know, sobering and important for us to think about when we're thinking about history and progress and lack of progress, because people were more uncomfortable and attacked her for her body, for her sexuality, much more than in the 20th century. I think earlier they were anxious about her rhetoric, and then there becomes this real focus on her sexuality. And, you know, that example, which is from the 1970s, it's fascinating that in communist Poland in the 1970s, they were putting on a production of the Canterbury Tales and illustrating it with The Wife of Bath. But you can see that The Wife of Bath has become entirely sexualized, entirely passive, a figure of the earth. I mean, the men don't come out of this very well either. There they are, eating their dinner off her belly. But it is, I think, really important to note how misogynist the kind of responses were. That, and then, you know, Pasolini's film, which, you know, both Peter and I are quite against Pasolini, I think. So we won't go into that anymore, because I want to get on to the recent examples, as Peter asked me about. But I think it's against that backdrop of how bad many things were in the 20th century. Though that's also when we get women writing novels about The Wife of Bath, and we get what James Joyce does, which is interesting, I think. So you also get her actually going into the novel, going more into prose, into silent forms, which causes all kinds of interesting formal innovations.
So stay there for a second.
Oh, yeah.
Where are we with The Wife of Bath and Molly Bloom?
So I have a chapter where I talk about what happens when she goes into the novel. So Molly Bloom, I mean, a lot of people don't realise how interested in Chaucer James Joyce was. And I was, because for obvious reasons, we think much more about the classical inheritance. But Joyce was really fascinated by the medieval. You talked about finding it more fecund for his writing than he found the classical period. You know, had multiple copies of Chaucer. You know, when he got to Paris and couldn't find his copy, he had to go borrow one immediately. Wrote on the parson when he was in Padua. You know, I mean, no one writes on the parson. That's really interesting. So Molly Bloom, I think there are lots of aspects of her which are drawing quite directly on The Wife of Bath. And when you look at some of the details around the way that she talks, I think that there's a close relationship, and people close to Joyce have, you know, pointed out a comparison as well. That, you know, I wasn't the first person to suggest that. I think when I was thinking about it, so one of the things, a way in which I suppose I would critique Joyce is that I think Joyce is much more interested in the idea of women, of woman as a type, and he writes about that, you know, about Molly as representing woman, which is a kind of fleshly, bodily concept, not an individualized concept. And in a way, Chaucer was taking very stereotypical ideas and trying to make them more individualized, not moving completely away from making them more individualized. And some of that has been removed, I think, in what Joyce does. But on the other hand, to kind of defend Joyce, one thing that I find extremely interesting is that she has the last word. You know, that he, the wife of Arthur, is a medial figure in the middle of the Canterbury Tales. Canterbury Tales, we don't know the order, but we know this certainly doesn't come last. Molly does get the last word, which I think is important. And I think in terms of form, obviously we're a poetry festival, what he does is, by giving Molly, you know, she just speaks in these incredibly long, breathless sentences with very little punctuation. He emphasizes the orality of it, because this is performance poetry. This is, you know, Chaucer is supposed to be read and heard and performed. And when people, and usually across time, she has been put into ballads, plays, performance poetry. When she's put into a silent form, you have to do something to kind of recognize the performativity.
Okay, go on with performance.
Yes. So, performance. So this is the most recent famous example of an adaptation of The Wife of Bath. So this is Zadie Smith's play, The Wife of Willesden, which was premiered in November 2021 at the Kiln Theatre in London, and then had another run in the winter season just gone, and then it went to Boston and New York a few months ago. Now, this is really quite a close translation adaptation of both the prologue and tale, but The Wife of Bath has become a 21st century... woman living in northwest London of Caribbean heritage, and her tale is no longer set in Arthurian Britain, it's now set in 18th century Jamaica amongst freed slaves. Now, Zadie Smith's play, I mean, I think it is a really brilliant version of The Wife of Bath, and it does stick quite closely to the text in all kinds of ways. I mean, she updates things so that the Book of Wicked Wives becomes a collection of books by people such as Jordan Peterson. And, you know, she says things like, you know, the shock never ends when women say things usually said by men, which I think is a nice quotation when you're thinking about a text that's gone on for 600 years. But Zadie Smith is writing, is not the first woman to have thought about The Wife of Bath in terms of diasporic culture in particular. And in the last kind of 20-odd years, really this century, there's been lots of examples of kind of post-colonial and diasporic reading of Chaucer in general in America and in other countries, as well as in Britain. And, you know, what I've put on a slide here is first of all, this is the opening of The Wife of Bath's prologue, which some of you might remember from school or other times, these famous lines, whether I won't read them all out because I know we're short of time. But I then put on here other versions by recent Black British poets. So this is Jean Binter Breeze, who just died 2 years ago. And if you Google The Wife of Bath in Brixton Market, you can see her reciting this as she walks through Brixton Market with all these surprised people around her. It's really a powerful performance, I think. And when I read bits of this out, I will just read them in my own accent, because I think it's really inappropriate for me to try to mimic any dialect that isn't my own. But I think you can see here the my life's my own Bible when it comes to all the woes in married life. For since I reached 12, thanks to eternal God, is five husbands he have, if that is possible. You can see how similar that is to experience the nunc torite, we're in this world, is rich enough for me to spake of woe that is in mariage, etc. Very similar, but she's put it into a Jamaican dialect of English. Patience Agbagbe, who is a contemporary British poet of Nigerian heritage, she's written a version of the whole Canterbury Tales. It's called Telling Tales, absolutely brilliant, where she uses many different poetic styles, including things very much associated with Black culture, such as grime poetry, but also things like mirror poems. I mean, she's such a talented poet, I think, Patience Agbagbe, and her form, she's so formally dexterous. But what you see, and she wrote her version of The Wife of Bath first, and then that prompted her to go on to write all the rest of the Canterbury Tales, at which point she rewrote The Wife of Bath as well. But you can see here, she's using Nigerian British dialect. And then Zadie Smith's version, so a real mix here. So let me tell you something. I do not need any permission or college degrees to speak on how marriage is stress. I been married 5 done times since I was 19. From me I dare me knee, but I survived, thank God, etc. And so you can see there that she's mixing some bits of colloquial English, some bits of very standard English, a line of patois, which is footnoted when you read the edition. And one of my favourite aspects of this, and I'm sorry, it's got a bit mangled here because the I being is supposed to be on the previous line, because that line, to speak on how marriage is stress, I being married five times since I was 19. So in that line, she seems to be speaking very authentically, very colloquially. But in fact, you know, this is written in iambic pentameter, which was the verse form that Chaucer invented. I mean, it was a rough form when he developed it, and other people, you know, refined it. But he was the first person to write in this five stress, 10-syllable line. And that line, to speak on how marriage is stress, I been, stress falls on a stress syllable, right? So this is the highly educated author who is showing, you know, kind of, you know, mocking this kind of idea of authentic performance, just as the wife of Bath is not the wife of Bath. She is not really an authentic, real woman. She is Chaucer, a highly educated man. And so that kind of playing with different levels of language is very, very Chaucerian. But I think to round back to the bigger question, one thing that I think is very interesting about the way that these poets play with standard English and dialect and different versions of English and say, you know, well, look, it's a generative and exciting thing to put this canonical text into different dialect forms. That's so true to the condition of language in the 14th century, which is before we have standard English. You know, standardizing is just beginning in some ways. But Chaucer's writing in a time of multiple dialects, when, you know, things like Gawain and the Green Knight are in a northwestern dialect. Langland's writing the West Midlands dialect. Chaucer's writing the dialect that becomes standard English, but it's not yet standardized. And also, crucially, English was not yet very much the language of the colonial oppressor. English was much more the subjugated language that had been colonized by French and Latin. Now, it was beginning its colonial journeys, and in Chaucer's lifetime, there were laws in 1366 in Ireland which were kind of, you know, promoting English against native languages. But that was just beginning, whereas we are much more used to the idea of English as a colonial language, which then diasporic writers are reclaiming. But I think it makes a lot of sense to reclaim it from that era before it had that kind of status. So I find that very, really interesting and kind of appropriate that those authors are doing that.
Marion, thank you for that brilliant tour de force. We have 10 minutes for questions from you in the room, you online. Please put your questions in the chat box if you can, and we'll have them relayed here. We have a roving microphone which tends to work best if you hold it 2 or 3 inches away from your mouth. Would you just put up a hand and we'll bring you a microphone? Or could you just wait for the mic, just so that everyone can hear you?
Marion, this is really just so someone says something. But I'm trying to remember from my studies of Old English and so on, how much with, as in modern usage, midwife, with woman, how much with can mean woman as well as wife, and if she can be the woman of Bath. I just can't remember the etymology.
No, absolutely. Yeah. So often it would just mean woman. Yeah. And I think that in this particular case, I think it does also have the connotation of specifically of wife, because so much of her identity is about marriage. Being married five times. Yeah. But it absolutely can just mean woman. Yeah, so the good wife can just mean the good woman.
Because it's quite interesting to think of her as a woman of Bath.
Yeah, and that is quite often how she gets translated in other languages as well. Yeah. So there's a recent Brazilian Portuguese translation which just calls her the mulher of Bath. I don't know Portuguese, but I think it's more like the woman, for example.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Yeah, question, sorry to whisk you with your microphone all the way to the back. Question at the back there.
I was wondering if there are any incarnations of the wife of Bath that we see in popular culture today, or if it's she's been so like subsumed by our culture now that she's everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So I think there's a few different levels. So that there are very specific adaptations of which are sometimes, you know, are reaching more people than something like a play can. So things like the BBC adaptation, which had Julie Walters in as the wife of Bath, for instance, about 20 years ago. There's also things like, so again, when I was researching this book, you can get Wife of Bath cheese. And in fact, the second version, they advertised it as now merrier and extra mature. So you could get this. There's also a soap, which I have. And the soap is, the soap has a tagline of something like the soap that women most desire. You know, so like the question in the tale. So you kind of spot her in these funny, you know, these funny little incarnations. But I think maybe the more general question is that, I think we often see kind of stereotypes of this kind of woman, which has probably become too diffuse for us to say it's specifically coming from the wife of Bath, though it may.
There's a question that's coming in from the internet, if you could just pass Jodie the mic.
Question from the internet is, fascinated by the Fuseli reverse portrait, did that start the Falstaff comparison for you?
Okay, so this is someone that's read the book, I think, so thank you for that. And so they are talking about an image in here, which is really interesting, because it's an image where, on what, I mean, you can't see it, I know, but I'm just holding it up because why not, where Henry Fuseli had painted a picture of the wife of Bath and painted over. So it was the wife of Bath, then it became a scene from The Merry Wives of Windsor, and so that it's a palimpsest of the two images. What I argue in my Shakespeare chapter is two different things. So one, that Falstaff is a version of the wife of Bath in all kinds of ways. You know, Shakespeare's favourite character, the character who is resurrected, who gets out of his text, who uses the same bits of the Bible as the wife of Bath to kind of justify his own kind of sins and crimes, who is self-aware and confessional in all kinds of ways that I think are very germane to the wife of Bath. And then I also argue that The Merry Wives of Windsor is based on the Prologue on Tales. So The Merry Wives of Windsor, a play about mercantile, middle-aged, sexually attractive women who are not sexually available to the knight who wants them. There's this scene in the woods with fairies, just as there is in the Wife of Bath's tale. So the answer to the question is no. I had those arguments, and then I later, through some quite random Google search, ended up finding that image, and it was just really serendipitous. It's one of those things where you kind of think, well, I mean, this doesn't really prove anything about my point, but it's just really interesting that there's this kind of double image which had been kind of scratched out and painted over. So it was just a kind of serendipity, but a really interesting one.
I think we've got time for one last question in the room, and then one from the internet. Please, one here.
Could you say something about the iambic pentameter? Because it doesn't really seem to have very much to do with Dante and the Italian poets he knew.
Yeah.
And to what extent did Chaucer apply rigidly throughout the poem?
Yeah, great question. So when Chaucer read Italian literature, he read, and I apologize for my pronunciation, but he read a line called the hendecasyllabic, something like that line, which was an 11-syllable line with two stresses in it. So there was a longer French line as well, but it didn't have stresses in it. So I think the Italian line is more relevant to Chaucer's development of the stressed 10-syllable lines. As I say, the Italian one was not identical, but I think was an inspiration for Chaucer Boccaccio was Chaucer's major. He uses Boccaccio's poetry more than anyone else's, and Dante's a great deal. So I think that was what helped him to develop the 10-syllable, 5-stressed line. He doesn't use it all the time, so in his early poetry, he was using an 8-syllable line, so in the Book of the Duchess and in the House of Fame, for example. And he may have returned to that, because we don't know the exact order in which he wrote all his poems, but certainly pretty much after he started using the 10-syllable line, that became his major form. Sometimes he did things like, he has some prose tales, some prose translations, and then in the tale that he gives his own persona to tell in the Canterbury Tales, he uses a different poetic form, a very debased kind of poetic form, because the whole thing is a joke that Chaucer himself can only use tale rhyme, which is a kind of rubbishy form for kind of populist writing. So he doesn't always use it. But also when he does use the iambic pentameter, it often in fact has 11 syllables. There's often an extra unstressed syllable at the end. The stresses often don't fall, you know, perfectly the way that a couple of hundred years they are supposed to, or some poets, you know, would expect them to. So it is a rougher, looser form. But basically, he does, after he first kind of develops it, he does use it for almost all his poetry, often in different kinds of stanza forms, but he uses it most of the time to that.
Very last question coming in online.
So, in view of what you said about the fluidity of English during Chaucer's time, with different dialects, etc., is it reasonable to say that Chaucer had a direct effect on the standardisation of English, and was it even conscious on his part?
Chaucer was, I think, part of the movement where, as I say, lots of people are writing in English, and partly it was not so much him having that effect, but he was in the right place at the right time because he happened to write in the dialect that was the dialect which became the language of bureaucracy, because he was in London. This is the East Midland London dialect. And so in Chancery, where English documents were now being produced, they were writing in that dialect. And that's the dialect that then became the standard. So then his poetry, of course, remained very influential, because when Caxton started to print, Caxton wanted to print things in the East Midland dialect. So Gawain doesn't get printed till the 19th century. You know, brilliant poem, but who wants to read things that aren't in southeastern dialect? You know, I'm from the northeast myself, so, you know, we all see that the tyranny of the southeast. So Chaucer was lucky in that he was writing in that dialect, which gets taken up by print, which gets taken up by court poets, and that became the dominant language, rather than it becoming the dominant language because he was writing in it, if you see what I mean. So he was in that area that became the most powerful area. You know, in his own lifetime, although London was, of course, hugely rising, but Parliament still moved around, for example. Great households moved around. You know, sometimes the law courts would just up and be shifted to York for a bit. You know, London wasn't the kind of powerhouse that it became a bit later. So that was a serendipity for Chaucer in a way.
I'm really sorry that we've come to the end. I know there are other questions. Do please talk to Marianne while she's signing copies of this book and her brilliant biography, Chaucer, A European Life, at the back. I want to thank all of you for coming. I want to thank Princeton University Press for their support for bringing Marianne here. I want to thank Joe Kingham for supporting this event, Arts Council England for their continued support for Ledbury poetry. And to everybody online, everybody in the room, thank you for being such a lovely audience. Marianne Turner.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Brilliant. Brilliant.